Hello.
Hello.
Oh, I didn't hear anything. I just heard some gentle noises. So,
Some mouse clicking.
some mouse clicking.
That's how I like to start. Some soft mouse clicking. It's like a nice anaerobic activity to get warmed up for podcasting.
Yeah, some calisthenics. So yeah, speaking of getting warmed up and ready to go and fueled by nothing but energy from the media we have consumed. We should probably pivot first into discussing that this is our member month, our member drive.
I was like, where are you going with this?
Yes. Oh, where did you think I was going with this?
Don't know. We talked about bread a lot last time,
Oh
and
no, we're not doing that. Bread is
no,
over.
I came prepared with some pie material. I ate a lot of pie.
Oh. Let's see if you can incorporate that pie material into our membership discussion.
Sure, I will attempt to come up with some metaphors.
Oh, God save us. So the important thing about Membership Month is that we don't have advertisements on the show, so we are entirely membership supported, meaning that you at home, listening to this, or even if you're not at home, you're probably in your car or somewhere else, like a coffee
Walking a dog,
shop.
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe you got your AirPods in. You're casually strolling through the pastry section of your local Safeway.
It's pretty generous to call it the pastry section, but
It's got a big sign above it that says bakery. There's a counter. Nobody's ever back there, but there's a counter.
okay. Yes, at your local Safeway patisserie, you can consider the words that we're saying, where if you sign up for a membership, you can get some special membership bennies, but also you can select shows like ours or other shows on the network individually based on the shows that you would like to divvy up your money to. So go ahead and check that defocus box if you like us. And if you don't like us, I don't know why you're listening to this, but that's your deal, I guess.
They come for the pie, they stay for the bond. Or vice
But
versa, who knows?
yeah, what kind of pie do you think James Bond likes?
Oh, that is a great question. I would love to talk about this for a really long time because I spent a little bit of time earlier today Googling why Bollinger is such an important beverage for James Bond. It's in all of the movies. And whatever, like, great. Have like a favorite champagne or something, but like, why does he have to be so brand specific? So I feel like he has very specific opinions about pie. Let's see. He doesn't strike me as a chocolate kind of person. Something a little weirder, something a little bit more on the edge. Maybe not like a rhubarb or something, but Is there anything traditionally British? Is there very British pie?
There
Aside
are,
from like meat pies?
I mean, there are a ton of British pies. What kind of pies do you think? Do you think he likes a dessert pie? I would
Oh
assume.
yeah. He's definitely a dessert kind of guy. He's have my dessert before dinner and then not eat dinner and just go sleep with some random waitress kind of pie lover.
Pie
Let's see the
lover.
top
Well,
10 British pies from British Corner Shop. Let's see what we got here.
something with a custard. Gonna guess.
The pork pie, the lamb shank. See, this is the problem. This is not
Ooh.
what I was talking about. It's not the kind of pies that I wanted.
Well, chess pie is British, so it could be chess pie, which
Is
is.
that got like kings and queens and knights in it and stuff?
Yes, exactly. And James Bond did it all for the rookie. So you can take that cookie-like crust and stick it
My God, you're stretching on that one.
Well, I don't know what else to do with it. It's a sweet pie. It is the basis of many other sweet pies. If you look at the sort of pie family tree, like it's vaguely related to a bunch of stuff that we have in America, but
Oh, I just did favorite British dessert pie, and the first like autocomplete from Wikipedia lists I never pronounce it properly, banoffee pie.
Ah, yes, banoffee. Yes.
I'm a big fan of banoffee pie.
Yeah.
I've had it many times. It's good.
I've never had banoffee anything. I just see it a lot on Great British Baking Show, Bake Off, that old chestnut.
Yeah, I never watched it.
Oh, it's such a good show. You're missing out.
I'm
Like,
sure.
really, just go back and watch the earliest season you can and all the way through. Even with the change in the hosts and one of the judges. Oh, there was drama. Because they moved off of one of the BBC things to a more commercial thing. And so two of the hosts left and one of the judges left because they supported the BBC and they were replaced. And there was much trepidation about what that would mean for the show, but it ended up being fine. They're just different, but the show's still good. So yeah.
It's like when Wheeler Dealers moved from England over to California and they replaced Ed with Ant. It was very sad.
I'm sure it is exactly like that.
Yeah, and then Ant went on and married Flipper Flop Lady.
Wait, what?
I'm connecting my universe to your universe. There's a British mechanic on a British car show that moved to California about 1.5 seasons ago, and then when he got to California, he married Christina El Moussa.
Okay.
Yeah, his name's Ant.
Well, I guess it can't be any weirder than Tariq, so good luck to them.
He sounds like the Volkswagen SUV.
Ant?
No, the Touareg.
Never mind. Sorry. Yeah.
Jesus.
I mean, I don't make fun of people's names, Dan. So
Oh God, how dare you? You were saying something about Member Month.
I was saying something about Member Month, and just like the disaster of an ad read for Member Month that we had last week, we will repeat that, only with less bread. We rely on members to support the show, so go ahead and do that, please.
Without your support, we couldn't buy pies at Safeway, or wherever Fancy Joe buys his fancy pies.
Well, I don't usually buy pies very often, but when I do, they're from Atticus cream. Oh wait, what is it called? Atticus
California chicken cream.
Atticus Creamery and Pies on Pico Boulevard. They make some good personalized
size. Like a personal pan pizza sized pie.
Yes, well, any pie is a personal pie if you try hard enough. But
it's true. I ate a lot of pie earlier.
Did you buy a full pie?
I bought a full pie, yes.
For what?
I mean, there's... What do you mean, for what? For eating.
No, but I mean, like...
I didn't buy it to, like, hit some person in the face when they came to my door to sell me, I don't know, landscaping or something.
But you have a household with two people?
Yeah. Two people that enjoy pie. What's wrong with that?
No, well, I mean, nothing other than you just bought a pie to unceremoniously eat during the week.
Is there a special day of the week that pie is acceptable?
No, it's just like a full pie just strikes me as something that's like for an event. Because my mom would always
Am I being too cavalier with my pie purchasing?
I suppose so. Because my mom would always make a pie for like family gatherings or something. It wasn't just like a I feel like making pie right now kind of a thing.
Well, you know what? I could be a family of one or whatever that eats a pie.
It's like those Army of One commercials, Family of One.
It's just me gearing up, getting ready for the day.
Getting ready to eat some pie.
Yeah, we eat more pie by 9 a.m. than most people do all day. Maybe I'll have some pie for breakfast tomorrow, I don't know.
Anyway, please give Dan money for pie.
please help me buy a pie.
Yeah, but in any event, even if you don't sign up for it, because of the pie, I'll tell you about some other stuff. We do a recording every week of this show live as we are speaking extemporaneously, and that is saved for later, and we edit that down to remove extraneous stuff after the show where we're just conversing, and that stuff...
The after show, as they call it, from time to time. We usually do a good, 15, 20 minute after show.
Yeah, and that stuff is uncropped, unexcluded from the so-called bootleg feed, where we post all of our episodes that are not edited yet. So you can go ahead and have all that extra content every week if you would like to. In addition to that, for membership month, we do a membership episode where there is an episode you can download from us that is exclusive to the people who are subscribing for membership. And so that in past years has included great guests like Scott from Random Trek, etc. And he was on for Lost in Space. And then we had Micah Sargent, who was on for the B movie because he really wanted to talk about the B movie. And there were a lot of questions about anatomy in that episode.
I mean, maybe not the answers people were looking for, but we had a lot of answers to people's questions. Not even people's questions. We answered our own questions.
Yes. It's yeah. I mean, it's definitely an episode where I got to play the straight man, which is something. I love Micah, but that's a unique experience. And we will be posting a membership episode again this year. You can listen to past years by signing up now, or you can listen to our current year by signing up. And if you sign up with the superhero tier, you get special stuff in the mail. More information on that is available to you if you go to incomparable.com and then look at the membership options. And that stuff has in the past included things like t-shirts and stickers and blah, blah, blah. So do whatever strikes your fancy, and sign up for whatever you would like. Be aware though, that the stuff that gets mailed out doesn't get mailed out till December. So if you are going to sign up, you got to be in it for the long haul. This is not like I've signed up for 1 month and I'm canceling and I will get stuff shipped to me thing. You will not. You gotta believe in us with all of your heart and your mind and your soul and your wallet. But that's,
you gotta buy us like at least a handful of pies.
Handful of, other than a hand pie, what is a handful of pies?
I feel like I could easily carry three pies in one hand stacked. Four, it gets a little wobbly because they're in those plastic containers that get all creaky and stuff.
Well, how many do you think you could carry if they were not inside of a plastic container, if they were homemade pies?
10 sort of a pie dish, or like an actual, like a what do you call, like Pyrex or something?
Let's say Pyrex. That'll give you the stability.
Do they have a like a lattice work or a top crust, or are they just sort of open on top?
For being nice, I will say they're open on top, but I will point out that even the ones that are open on top are going to have a crust that goes over the edge of the dish.
Sure, but that's just sort of like a ring of stability. Like I feel like a lattice work would provide a little bit more stability across. It would distribute the weight of the pies above it.
I'm never letting you carry pies. That much is clear.
You're saying that they would rest directly on the ring of crust around the outside of the pie and nothing else, and that's okay?
No, I'm just saying that you would do damage to the ring of crust.
Yeah, yeah. But that's why if you had a lattice work, it would more evenly distribute the weight.
But if you had a lattice
anyway,
work...
Anyway, it's bringing it down to probably two pies per hand because the Pyrex is heavy.
But it would slip.
Well, I mean, only if you tilt it.
All right, well, anyway...
You need to go to British James Bond finishing school so you can balance some pies on your head and not like drop them.
Yes, yes. They teach that at Oxford. So, in conclusion, please sign up for a membership with the Incomparable and get all the member bennies and support us, please. And Dan's just because weekly time of the whatever. Purchasing of pies at a Safeway.
Is it weekly, like I buy a pie every week? This is a special occasion.
What is the special? That's what I asked you. You said there was a special occasion. That wasn't the special occasion.
I'm allowed to buy a pie for no reason. It's not. I don't have to do it on a recurring interval for it to be a non-special occasion.
Well, how often do you buy a pie for no reason?
It's probably been like a year or two. I don't know. We just wanted some dessert. And...
Okay. And what kind of pie did you buy?
I don't even know if I want to tell you.
You have to.
I mean, you're going to make fun of it anyway. We bought a banana cream pie. I bought a banana cream pie. They had a key lime. I wanted a lemon meringue pie, but they didn't have one. They had a lemon, like lemon special or something. It was just a lemon meringue pie, but they put frosting on top of it for some reason. But they had a key lime pie that had a meringue on it, but I didn't want that because it was going to be a really gross key lime pie.
I don't love meringue as a pie topping. TBH.
You know, it's another one of those things. I haven't had in a very long time, and I had a craving for a lemon meringue pie, and, you know, Safeway let me down.
So I got a question then. If you like meringue on top of your pie, why didn't you want the key lime meringue?
Because the key lime was almost guaranteed to be a disappointing filling.
Well,
the meringue can't stand on its own. The filling has to really, like, you know, work with it.
But they're both citrus.
In a sense.
Interesting. I would say
you're assuming that these are I don't know, sort of artisanally crafted homemade pies. Like, you know, all things being equal, yeah, key lime and a lemon meringue are pretty similar, but in the freezer section of the Safeway, yeah, I'm not so sure.
Wait, this is in the freezer section?
Or whatever, the bakery, they've got that thing that's like a little refrigerator, but it's not like a refrigerator. It's like a big, looks like a table with like little walls that curl around the edge.
Yes, but that's not a freezer, Dan.
Well, it's a refrigerator.
Yes. But I just want to make sure you weren't like buying some Sara Lee stuff. But
No. There was a frozen lemon meringue pie that I walked past when I bought a tub of yogurt. Yeah. I didn't want to buy it.
No. See, here's the thing. I don't enjoy eating things that I don't feel like will be fulfilling for me. So,
no, see, and this is the thing. I was driving home from the Safeway with my Safeway banana cream pie in the car, and I could just hear your voice in my head saying, "I would rather not have a pie than have a Safeway banana cream pie." And I was like, "You know what? Get out of my head, Joe voice, because you're going to be in my head later when you tell me these same things on the podcast." But I haven't had a Safeway banana cream pie in a very long time.
Well, was it good?
It was better than no banana cream pie for years on end. So yes, it was good.
Okay. I'm glad it ended your banana cream pie drought.
It's true.
But
we had a drought. It was very unseasonably un-pie-like season. I don't know. I don't know if it's dry or moist or whatever.
Well, with the banana cream pie, I would say it was unappealing.
It's accurate. There were no peels in it. That would be weird if there were banana peels in the pie.
Yes. No, but yeah. I mean, it's not my favorite pie, but
I wouldn't say it's my favorite pie either, but it's a good pie.
Well, then what's your favorite pie?
My favorite pie. You know, it's probably grown in appeal because we have it very infrequently because Amanda does not like super dry-ish, like crusty type pies. And most apple and or cherry pies have a good deal more crust than some other pies, and I very much enjoy an apple and a cherry pie. So those are high on my list. It's been a very long time since I've had them, though.
Interesting.
I like a banoffee pie, though.
Okay. Acceptable. I will allow that. I don't love cherry pie. I would prefer apple in that scenario. And then banana below that. Not that I hate banana, but I just don't value it as much as a flavor, especially not one from Safeway. But the my ideal pie is, of course, key lime pie. And you would know that if you listen to Unhelpful Suggestions that I do with Michael Sargent about every other week. And we had a pie episode, and I talked at length about my love of key lime pie. Really?
Yeah, but you have specific requirements for key lime pie.
Yeah, it's got to be good. It can't be crap. Which I don't
love all key lime pies equally. I feel like the testament of a favorite pie is one that even when it's bad, you still enjoy it.
Yeah, and I will say this. I would rather have a bad apple pie than a bad key lime pie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because with a bad apple pie, I feel like there's just extra corn syrup gelatin filling that you can just scrape out and then just eat the apple bits and the pie crust, whereas with like a bad key lime pie where they use inferior citrus components or other things, or it's just gotten soggy or weird because of the crust, then that is definitely not edible. You just get into a point where you just don't want to like even finish touching the pie.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Even a bad apple pie, you heat it up a little bit, smack some vanilla ice cream on top, and it's infinitely better.
Yeah. But there are a variety of apple pies. So I got to ask you, lattice, closed top, like completely closed, or one of those funky ones like down under?
What's a down under apple pie?
That is a cheddar streusel that is on the top.
I have never had a cheddar thing on top of an apple pie. I've never tried it. It seems weird. It's probably fine. Never tried it. But when it comes to lattice or covered or whatever, I don't care. I am apple pie agnostic.
Interesting. You have no opinion on the subject.
I don't. Because if there's too much stuff on top, I'll chop it up a little bit. And I'll make it into a little bit of a crumble kind of thing, and I'll just mix it all around so it's less pie like. And you can evenly distribute the crust and the apple.
Yeah, I mean, except for something like like Dutch crumb top or something like that. Anyway,
well, I would be okay with that too.
Well, that's enough pie and membership. For us.
Pie and membership.
Yep.
What's your favorite things?
So, for this week,
yeah,
we finished our...
Let's turn this thing down a little bit. Let's take a little bit of the energy, a little wind out of our sails.
Let's pivot from pie to Pierce Brosnan and his final Bond film.
Pierce Brosnan?
Yes. We'll pie another day.
I mean, these work because, his name is, it does technically start with pie.
Yeah. So.
And I would rather pie another day than die another day.
Yeah.
How great would that be if, if the disguise, from what's his name, instead of getting, his DNA surgery so he could die another day, that he just like ate pies until he gained a bunch of weight, so then he was unrecognizable.
I mean, I don't know if I would say how great would it be, but
just by virtue of the fact that you could then call the movie Pie Another Day.
I suppose. So let's just get into it. This movie is bad.
Stupid. This movie is very stupid.
It is all over the map. It is several movies all sort of glued together very haphazardly. It is tonally all over the map. It is
prior to Casino Royale, it was the highest grossing Bond film somehow worldwide. It's incredibly long, and it's disjointed doesn't even begin to describe it, because just like there are the They went from mixing a lot of the small components of the James Bond films, which they've been doing for the past couple of films, to mixing like very large thematic components of the James Bond films. Like this guy's plot is very strange and very large, and there are several of them. You follow the thread and you remember a lot of the things because there's a lot of big action set pieces that are very stupid. But it's just none of it is, it's not coherent. I mean, I get what happens in the movie. It's so beyond unbelievable that you're just like, all right, whatever, I guess I give up now. And I just let the movie hit me in the eyes.
Well, I think for me, the frustration is that, it's a Bond movie where I don't even remember this movie very much in terms of detail.
Lucky you, I remember the hell out of this movie.
Which is weird, because, like, I remember the most of, I would say, GoldenEye and Tomorrow Never Dies. And I remember the larger story points of The World Is Not Enough, with a lot of empty space in between. And then for Die Another Day, I remembered... there's North Korea, and then there's Cuba, and then there's
Iceland.
I didn't even remember Iceland. I just remember there was an ice palace, and there's the invisible car.
Yeah.
And I remembered the laser from space, and not running the laser from space. But
you didn't remember the ultrasonic wedding ring that cracks glass?
No, I didn't. This movie did not stick with me at all. And I think it's because I hated it. When I saw it, I didn't like this movie. And years later, I still hate this movie.
Well, you'll be surprised to know that this movie was on television a lot because it's very long and a lot of things happen. And I've seen it many times. So that's probably one of the many reasons it sticks with me. I mean, the Aston Martin, the Vanquish, is beautiful. So that also helps it. And then the absurdity. I mean, look, I like Pierce Brosnan. I think he's a good Bond. He does a pretty good job in this movie. As we discussed previously in a couple different locations online, he is beginning to age out of this role a little bit, especially when compared to the very young women in the film. Also, I don't know why Halle Berry's in this movie. I like Halle Berry. I don't like her in this movie at all. Like, she does nothing for me. It could be a still image of a piece of celery with ADR, and it would be exactly the same movie for me.
I think this is unfortunately part of Halle Berry's early career, where she was cast in things as something to ogle at, and so she didn't really get her due.
Also, Swordfish.
Yeah, well, yeah, Swordfish, and also X-Men, the first one.
You know what happens to a toad when it gets struck by lightning?
It loses its accent in and out over the course of the film.
Oh, she had an accent in that movie?
It's close, sort of, kind of.
What was her accent?
Unclear.
I thought Storm was American.
Not really. In the comics, she's from an African area that seems to change. But yeah, no. This is a situation where. I don't begrudge Halle Berry for this, but this character as written is no good, and the stuff that she's given in terms of direction, like, I don't think she was swaying her hips back and forth
coming out of the ocean.
Yeah, just because she was like, this is me, this is my character, this is my spy character. I think she was doing that, like, maybe because kind of guess. It had something to do with direction she was given, because I just don't understand why else you would do that.
Well, you know, she starts, this one's interesting. She doesn't start off as spy and then become James Bond girlfriend kind of character. She starts off as James Bond girlfriend character, then kind of becomes really weird spy lady, and then ends up James Bond girlfriend again.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's not a turn most of them have, but she's Jinx Johnson, and the bad guy is Gustav Graves.
I don't like any of the names, but
then you got Colonel Moon, you got General Moon, you got Goodnight Moon,
Miranda Frost.
Yeah, because she's, you know,
cold.
She's kind of cold and chilly.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the movie.
Yeah, and of course, our favorite character of all of them, and that is Verity. The fencing coach played by Madonna.
Madonna did a great job
at
recording her audition and somehow slipping that into the film.
Wow. So this movie starts in North Korea. they
technically
have...
it starts in international waters on a surfboard.
Oh God, the surfing. So, Bond and two presumably South Korean agents surf into North Korea, and then they go to a listening post or something where they can set up a thing to summon...
They turn off the guidance satellite and then set up their own, like, mini knife satellite to redirect the helicopter with the random British guy to land somewhere, and then they take over. They take his diamonds, and, you know, they already know what he's wearing, so they, you know... So I don't have to take his outfit because it would be cold. That's a good thing. And then they take the helicopter and then they go land and meet with the bad guy to try and exchange African conflict diamonds for weapons. You know, given James Bond, this is his fourth movie now where Pierce Brosnan's just been walking around telling everybody his real name. They pretty much just take a picture of him and then, you know, send it to somebody. And they're like, yeah, that's James Bond. That's not the guy. That's a spy.
Some really high DPI on that Sony Ericsson candy bar phone.
Was it another Sony? Or I kind of looked. It looked a little Nokia-ish. Maybe it's probably Sony though.
No, this was Sony Ericsson. You could definitely see the logo. And this is after the company was Sony Ericsson.
Oh right. So with the merger happened in the midst of these movies, huh?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it looked like it had a decent sized optical lens on it, but you know, it's James Bond.
If
you drive a car with one, he can get a nice optical zoom lens on
another
one.
It was a pretty silly looking insert.
Oh yeah, all of the inserts are terrible.
Yeah.
There was what movie was it? It was this one or the other one, or another movie I was watching entirely where a security camera footage like did a jib move down to like ground level. Oh, I don't remember. I was watching something.
Well, thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah, thanks. I'm getting old now. My brain is becoming mush like a banana cream pie.
Yeah. So, much like mush, we set up some C4 inside of the briefcase that has diamonds on top. Then there's a confrontation with the guy when he reports him. So the son of the general who lives this outlandish Western lifestyle, basically supported by the fact that his father has power. He turns around and like I don't know, RPGs or what was it, uranium depleted bullets,
depleted uranium. Large caliber rifle rounds through the helicopter.
Yeah, and he blows up the helicopter with the two surfing operatives. So they can no longer hang 10 on this one. And then the Zhao or whatever is over by the suitcase. Bond sets it off. It explodes, sending diamond shrapnel into Zhao, which is a notable feature for the rest of the film, only visually and in no way anything we care about. But
pretty dope look, by the way. I wish that would have caught on instead of like grills or whatever, because the diamonds in the face is a good look.
I don't know about that one.
It would have been funny like if he was laughing when James Bond set it off and he got a couple diamonds embedded in his teeth too.
I think that might have, I would say that would be stretching it a little too far, but then I saw the rest of this movie. So the
you mean where he's like a giant blobular varicose vein with diamonds in his face.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a good look either. After this explosion goes off and the diamonds get embedded in his face, Bond takes one of the hover cars that they brought the weapons in on and chases after, the son of the general.
By the way, I feel obligated to say to our listeners out there who may find themselves in a situation where there's a minefield between them and a place they want to go. Don't try to take a hovercraft over top landmines, because despite the fact that Colonel Moon said he glides right over all of the landmines, they would absolutely blow up and destroy you.
Yeah, yeah. I really like raised an eyebrow at that one, too.
Do you know how hovercraft worked?
Oh, man.
Colonel Moon there. It pushes down, maybe with air instead of feet, but it forces air down such that it pushes the vehicle off the ground. And that force would probably set off all of the landmines.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do that. Anyway, there's a chase with hovercrafts, and he's shooting RPGs, and he's got flamethrowers, and he's got depleted uranium stuff, and then they crash into each other, and there's hand-to-hand combat, and then he floors it, and Colonel Moon gets stuck against the little blades at the back there, the intake of the fan, and he's stuck there, and then the hovercraft goes over the waterfalls into Niagara Falls, and James Bond jumps up in the air and grabs onto a very large, Buddhist bell-type thing that's ringing.
There's basically a wooden log that swings into the bell to ring the bell. And so he grabbed onto that. And then he says, "Saved by the bell," which is a timely reference.
Yeah. Especially in 2002.
Oh,
2002.
Man. Yes.
Additional notable occurrences in 2002. I graduated high school.
I graduated high school in 2001.
Yeah. Well, this is November, so I guess I was, starting college.
Mm? I was in college.
Yeah. We were college boys watching this.
Yeah, yeah.
We were so educated. We were like, this strains credulity a little bit. Thank you very much.
But they, after this,
I'm gonna write a paper about this in English 101.
After this disappointing action sequence, Bond is apprehended by.
He's imprisoned during an opening credit sequence.
Yeah, and this is the father caught him, but for some reason is going to torture him instead of killing him. His son having gone over the falls. No one seems to check on that. But we get this interleave with the credits where he's getting his head dunked into ice water and then back out again. And then there's CGI dancing fire things and CGI dancing ice things. And I have to say, of the four Pierce Brosnan titles, this is my least favorite.
Well, there's story elements in here too, though. It's less stylized because they're doing story stuff.
Yeah, but the story is not interesting. It's just interleaving every now and then with him being tortured. But the quality of the work, I don't think, is up to what I would have expected based on the previous films. And there were scenes where there were shots where he dissolves from normal photography to like the solarized, like orange and purple photography, like he's on fire-ish kind of, and it's just not effective. So I'm disappointed in that. It is the same title designer in all of these. This is Kleinman doing all of these. So I don't know if it was just like over ambitious in terms of what he could do digitally now, as opposed to what he had been able to shoot photographically before.
Luckily, there is one thing about the opening credits that makes up for all of these flaws in the design.
You're not going to say the song, are you?
The song!
This is also my worst... This is my least favorite of the Bond, Pierce Brosnan opening titles. It is horrible. This makes Ray of Light look like Vivaldi's Four Seasons. This is such an auto-tuned, mangled disaster that I just absolutely hate it on every level, every fiber of my being. Especially when you get to like those little lines where she's like trying to say something, it doesn't rhyme with anything else. So you'd be like, "Oh, I hope this is important and worth doing that." And instead, it's like Sigmund Freud, and you're like, "Wait, what? Like, you're just gonna say Sigmund Freud? Like that? That's it? It doesn't connect to anything in this film."
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, he has some psychological issues,
but not. You don't just say Sigmund Freud.
Well, the lyrics are apparently by someone named Mirwais Amadzi. I don't know how to pronounce this. Amadzi.
I mean, she still approved this and said, "Sure, yes, I will do this."
Yeah, I agree.
And Barbara Broccoli is still like, "Yes, this is a great idea. I want her."
It's catchy, though. It's catchy.
It is not. It is the opposite of catchy.
It's catchier than the Dirty Vegas remix in the end credits.
Ugh.
Remember Dirty Vegas?
No. I mean,
Days Go By? They did a song around the same time.
That was them?
Yeah.
Wow.
Anyway.
All around unfortunate music choices here. I think they really...
Great song.
I think they... I mean, I don't like The World Is Not Enough, but I thought that David Arnold collaborating with Garbage to do the opening titles for that one yielded a pretty good result, because then you could also incorporate the theme from that into the rest of the score that he was doing. Whereas something like this, it's just like, nope, not connected to the rest of this film. It's just some random thing that happens here. And then a music video outside of this that will, I don't know. It was probably on TRL live at the time.
Oh,
so,
I'm sure it was.
Yeah. The incentives for having Madonna do this were a little skewed at the time, where you could get the music video played, and nowadays nobody would care about the music video. So tough luck. And speaking of, Dan,
yeah,
I asked you to watch the music video.
Yeah,
it was not good. I don't like the music video, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on that as somebody who considers himself a director of small projects.
Well, first of all, it's important to limit your expectations, because I don't think there's ever been a music video for a song that was specifically made for a film that has been good, because it always has to be part of the film. And most of them are lazy, where they're just like a really like half-hearted performance intercut with just like random footage from the movie. It just gives you like a trailer version of sort of the story.
Yeah, like
no connection.
Hey Now You're an All-Star, which I believe is actually just titled All-Star, by Smash Mouth. That one actually is a tie-in for Mystery Men.
Right, Mystery Men was a movie.
Yes, so there's random shots from Mystery Men inside of the music video for that one, and it's just like, what?
Yeah, so there's usually two ways that a made-for-film song gets a music video. It's either that, where they're just intercutting arbitrary footage, maybe sometimes with like a single additional shot specifically for the music video at the beginning, or more often the end of the music video, where everyone is like sort of in costume, but like they didn't really do their hair or their makeup again to tie it like just back in to just like, you know, high five the musician or something. And then the other route that they take is where the musician basically is playing the main character from the movie in like a small version of the movie as a music video, which they usually pick, you know, one or two of the more iconic scenes and just sort of recreate them that way, which is what this music video does. So Madonna is being tortured, similar to the opening credits sequence, for which she does the song, being dunked in water, being beat up. And then there's this really unusual scene where she's in an all white room with white furniture, fencing against herself, and one of her is dressed in white, one of her is dressed in black. You know, presumably, her internal struggles, her good side, her bad side fighting.
Yeah, which was definitely a theme of this film.
Internal demons, and who are we really underneath?
No, it was not a theme of this film.
I could make this pitch work. Don't just.
Anyway, it's bad. It's not a good music video, but the important part is it concludes, and
the important part is that it concludes.
Yeah, and General Moon is there to greet James Bond and say blah blah blah, it's your last chance, whatever, and then they take him to this bridge to do a prisoner exchange. Because he wants to get as much information out of him as possible before the prisoner exchange occurs. He's exchanged for Zhao, and he goes back to the South Korean side of the demilitarized zone over this bridge. And so he is rescued, sort of. He's immediately incapacitated by an injection, and then taken to be analyzed by British scientists who scan him with robot arms that seemingly do nothing. And say that he's definitely James Bond because his liver is not in great shape.
And it really sounds like the same guy having a conversation with himself over an intercom.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you're generalizing about British people, Dan.
But... No, it just sounds like a guy playing two sides of a conversation.
But he's on a hospital bed, and then M walks in, and then it's revealed that Bond is behind a glass partition, and she explains that he was basically released because there was a leak of information that could have only been known by him, and he was the only resident, and it came from his place. And so they suspect that he cracked, and he has to go to a special facility in the Falklands to be evaluated. Mm. So,
can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
Real quick. I would just like to mention that the music video was nominated for Best Video from a Film for the 2003 MTV Video Music Awards, but it did not win.
Well, good, because it's garbage. But also, if it had won, I would still say the awards are garbage. But what did win?
Of course, Eminem, Lose Yourself, won. But it was also up against stiff competition from J.C. Chazet, who did a song for Drumline, apparently. And Britney Spears and Pharrell, who did a song for Austin Powers' Gold Member.
Okay.
2002, 2003 was a very bad time. We've discussed this before, that the early 2000s were an abomination that should be wiped from the record of popular culture.
Yeah, I think everybody was just excited their bank accounts didn't explode. So they just didn't know what to do with themselves. But James confronts Em about this, and she leaves. And then he sees all these, like, hand pads and crap, and determines that he will slow his heart rate down enough that people will come in to resuscitate him with paddles, and then he uses them on the guys, and then escapes through the thing. And the nurse lady who had been there as an assistant seems completely unaware she's supposed to be acting in the scene.
Because, yeah, he says, you know, in a very James Bond way, thanks for the kiss of life. And you get the sense that she was supposed to, like, raise an eyebrow or something, or, like, give a little half smile, but she was incapable of doing that.
No.
So she just kind of, like, stares.
She's...
I would have at least, like, grabbed, like, a spline warp or something and, like, raised the corner of a mouth or something in post.
Every shot of her is just like a blank stare. But he leaves, and then he goes to the top deck and jumps overboard.
Yeah, the alarms are going off. The alarms that sound nothing like alarms on land or on a boat or anywhere ever. Just some sound effect that somebody found. And then he dives into the ocean, I guess, and swims to land and pops out conveniently right next to the the Hong Kong rowing club or something. There's a sign there in English that lets him know where he is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it would make sense there would be a sign in Hong Kong in English, because it was a British colony up until like the late 90s. So,
I suppose.
Yes. But he goes and wanders off to a hotel, looking
just
all...
Just walks down the street in his wet pajamas with his shirt unbuttoned. Couldn't even button his shirt. Like, yeah. Maybe it's because it's extra cold out or something, and he didn't want to, get hypothermia, and he thought he could, like, dry off a little easier by leaving it unbuttoned. But, you know what? Cover yourself when you're in the lobby of a hotel, sir. Yeah.
Tactically unbuttoned. Also, no shoes. Because
at this point, I don't think he's tactically unbuttoned. I think he's recklessly unbuttoned.
And... he has a very unappealing, bedraggled look, where it's just like, no, you're not pulling this off. You don't seem debonair.
An unappealing look. Sorry, he couldn't shave more often when he was a prisoner of war in Korea.
He was a prisoner for 18 months, they say. So I want you to think about that timetable when you're discussing the events that occur later in the film. But he... is recognized by somebody who works at the hotel, who gets in the presidential suite.
It can't be 18 months, because M says Miranda was only there for like 6 months, and she was the one who betrayed him. Spoiler alert, she's the one that betrayed him.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
No, but he was there apparently for 18 months.
Right.
Anyway.
I feel like his beard would be bigger in 18 months.
Or... fingernails or something. Like, I don't know what's going on with the personal
hygiene. He could bite those.
Yeah, but he goes up to his room, and he gets a masseuse who has a ridiculous name. She comes in.
Well, he has a tailor in Hong Kong, too. Don't forget that. They send the tailor up and some food and some Bollinger. Some 61 Bollinger, of course.
I believe you are well aware that there are tailors in Southeast Asia who will do custom jobs for you.
Yeah, but he requests his tailor.
Yes.
I guess I have a tailor in the sense that I went to a tailor in Vietnam who made me a very attractive bespoke suit. I wonder if I still fit in that. I really doubt it.
You should put it on, Dan.
I should. No, I need to get it, see if I can get it updated for modern taste, because the pant legs are a little bit too wide for a modern design. I can just start wearing the blazer around.
I mean, is it like a zoot suit riot, or what's going on with it?
No, just the pants are a little baggier than modern sensibilities.
Oh, okay. All right.
Just they're a little sure. Little too much 501, and they need to be a little more 511.
Hmm. Okay. Well, Bond has the masseuse come in, who has the ridiculous name, and then pulls the gun that she had on the inside of her thigh on her, and then shoots the mirror, revealing that there were people recording on the other side of it.
He didn't shoot the mirror. He throws an ashtray at it.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. He throws the ashtray at the mirror.
So stupid.
Yeah. And the safety glass breaks everywhere. And you can tell it's safety glass because it turns into tiny little pebbles. And all of the guys who are there, the camera crew, everybody comes out because they are... they have a gun on them. Chang, the guy who recognized them in the lobby, is all like, hey, what's up? And he's like, yeah, I always knew
not
you
only
were.
Am I the concierge? I am also in here with headphones on recording you.
Yeah, he was like, Bond's like, I always knew you were a Chinese agent. That's why, you know, I sought you out. I'm here to get Zhao and blah, blah, blah. Because M had said that there was some sort of summit where Zhao had killed a bunch of people from China in addition to a bunch of people from South Korea in an effort
killed
to...
three agents.
Yeah, to sabotage the situation. So... he's relying on Chang's, I don't know, like, desire for revenge or something. And so Chang's like, okay, sure. Now, originally, this role was going to be played by Wei Lin, Michelle Yeoh.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But they rewrote this kind of when she was not available or something.
Or not interested.
I'm going to assume it was the second thing, but... He gets this box, this lacquered box full of airplane tickets and passports and money and a gun. And he's sent on his way to go to Havana because that's where their intelligence says Zhao is right now. And, you know, he's told to say goodbye from them. And James Bond arrives in Havana. He goes to a cigar factory and introduces himself and does the whole global exports thing.
Universal exports, sir. Yeah,
sorry, Universal exports, and gets himself invited to talk to the boss.
Because he's asking for very special cigars, delictados that have not been made in 30 years.
Yes, and this is apparently all code words. And... the code words are recognized and acknowledged and whatever. And so he's invited to the inner...
secret cigar handshake has occurred.
Yeah, he's invited to the inner sanctum where...
which is a patio on the roof.
Well, then there's the other inner sanctum where they go to his weird tobacco-soaked lobby thing, den with the...
it kind of looks like a C-grade private eyes office.
Yes. That's a good way to describe it. They have their conversations about the past and how, you know, he's not interested in overthrowing anything, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they talk about Zhao, et cetera. And there's some information that he's on Los Organos or Los Oreganos. I think it's Los Organos.
It's called Los Oreganos, and they have deep dish pizza.
Yes. Wait,
I forget. Is oregano a local thing here? Is that made its way to other states?
I've never heard of that.
You've never heard of oreganos?
No.
Oh, they make deep dish pizza.
Do they now?
Yeah, it's like a Lou Malnati's, except local, and they put lots of oregano on stuff.
Oh, is it palatable?
It's good, yeah. It's very expensive, and it takes like, you know, an hour and a half to cook a pizza or whatever the hell it is, but it's good.
I mean, I like oregano. I like a lot of oregano. But there's a certain point
Then you would potentially like oreganos.
But there's a certain point where you get to oregano overload, where you're just like, oregano, thank you. but I have to imagine that's not a problem for them on Los Oreganos Island. And so he requests a fast car and is given, I don't know what the heck that is. Is that a Cadillac? Thunderbird.
It looked like he was driving a Cadillac. The joke being that you know, due to the embargo, Cuba doesn't have modern cars. They have old cars they fix up and try and keep working.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you see him drive to an island. We didn't see the part where he gets from, you know, the actual like one island to the other island, but whatever. Unless he never actually gets to the island until the little ferry thing.
Yeah, I think it might be the ferry. Okay. I think it's just the tiny island that looks like a fortress is also the hospital.
Okay. So that's Los Oreganos.
But it literally doesn't matter because he's James Bond, so he's on a mission, but he just goes to the nearest bar where he can like see his target, but he can hang out for the night.
Yeah, and he had borrowed binoculars and a book on birds because that's his cover. He's an ornithologist.
He's a tall, debonair looking ornithologist. And, you know, this bar has all of the telltale signs of a James Bond bar. There's nobody sitting at the bar. They make James Bond a mostly clear beverage, in this instance, a mojito, because he's in the tropics and not just drinking martinis. That would look weird out on a patio. He would stick out. There is a table full of loud, annoying bad guys that have guns, which will come into play shortly. And then you got a hot lady in the beach area that he can stare at creepily with his binoculars.
Yes. And the way that James Bond says mojito is spectacular.
It's terrible. He's trying to do a local accent.
Yeah.
Because you know, when you say Spanish words, you're supposed to say them with a Spanish accent, but he's incapable of saying the word mojito.
Yeah, but which is something where I feel bad too. I would make a terrible secret agent, by the way, because I would feel bad about not pronouncing it correctly, or self-conscious about not pronouncing it correctly, and thus make it even worse.
Well, this is the thing, though. Yeah. As John Roddick has said, don't speak with the local patois. You just use your words. Say the name of the thing.
Yeah,
it's a mojito. You don't have to try and be all fancy about it.
I know, but then I don't want to sound like those guys who are at the table. The bad guys who are all like waving around guns.
Jerky Australians.
Are they Australian or are they South African?
It might even have been New Zealander.
Maybe it's all of the above.
Maybe it's all of the above. Maybe they are mercenaries from around the globe that have come together here to get drunk and harass a waitress and then later go get some DNA therapy.
Yes. Yes, as one does.
It's a very vibrant business over there. I mean, I assume that hospital does more than just DNA therapy. Like, that's why they have the, you know, the little secret hiding room in the corner. But, you know, they got to be doing all kinds of stuff over there.
Yeah, I mean, why waste a whole castle? I would
use them, like, every bit of the castle, personally.
So they it's revealed through this loudmouth bad guy that they're all going over there for gene therapy. So we know that in the audience. James Bond knows that. Halle Berry is all like, hi, I'm wet and swaying my hips.
My name's Jinx. Let's have some very unsubtle innuendo and jokes about predators and sunrise and sunset and feasting and stuff. So basically, it's some of the most cringy kind of like stuff you see your drunk friends doing in a bar, like trying to pick up people, and it's terrible. And they shouldn't have captured it on film.
No,
it's embarrassing.
No, it's really embarrassing for everybody involved. Because also at this point, Pierce Brosnan is unfortunately advanced to the age range of some of the later Roger Moore movies, where it's sort of like an older gentleman hitting on a younger woman, and you're like, this is not as appealing to me or interesting to watch, and I feel kind of gross.
Yeah, he's, I think I looked it up, he's, 13 years older than Halle Berry?
I mean, that's not bad. I don't want to imply...
Could be worse. Could be worse. Could be 26 years older.
I don't want to imply that there is something bad about the age range between Halle Berry and Pierce Brosnan, but it's just there's something in their dynamic that doesn't work.
It's typical Hollywood, you know, age politics and that kind of crap.
Yeah,
but once you get into that next decade, there, nah,
no. And, which is strange, because this is also, I think, the movie where James Bond has the most sex. But
Pierce, he has three. He has three sex.
So he invites Halle Berry up to his room. They do stuff, and then she departs in the morning and goes on the boat to go to the island. And he realizes he needs to go on the boat to the island. So he knocks out one of the bad guys from last night, puts him in a wheelchair, and uses his paperwork to get them both onto the island because he poses as the person who's taking him there.
Yeah, and he basically does the same thing he did in the other movie where he pretends to light a cigarette. He just knocks on the guy's door like, I don't know, not even like he's, you know, room service or something, because he's not holding anything. And the guy opens the door in his angry accent, and he's like, "What do you want?" Then he just punches him, and drags him out, even though his lady friend is still there in the bed.
Yes.
But James Bond is so smooth. He's just like, "Good morning, young lady," and she's like, "Eh, cool, whatever. Well, I don't care."
He said, "Buenos dias."
Sure.
Yeah. Sure he did. So they go down to the boat, and they get on the boat.
Buenos mojito.
What's weird is either they shuttled Halle Berry over, and then the boat came back, and then shuttled them over, or they were both on the same boat and said nothing to each other the entire time.
No, she got there first, because she's halfway through a meeting with a creepy doctor guy who is, he's like a regular, boring general practitioner doctor, but also he likes inflicting pain on people.
Yes.
Because he's an artist.
Yeah.
But they really just picked like a guy who just looks like a pediatrician.
Yeah. And he talks about how he has a special therapy where they hollow out all of your marrow and then they replace it with stuff they get from orphans and people that won't be missed. But it's good, healthy genes. And then you'll be amazing afterwards. Apparently another thing you can do with this is change the ethnicity of someone through this gene therapy, which is an added wrinkle that I don't really think anybody was looking for, but it's here. It's an essential plot element.
Yeah. I mean, when you're talking about, swapping DNA, one person for another, you don't need to have logic because none of it works or makes any sense. No. So the idea is that you trade your DNA for other people's DNA, and then your body like recompiles its code and goes like, "Oh, I guess I'm a white guy who looks like this," and then it changes you, as opposed to just like what a normal human being would do, and they would just get, you know, plastic surgery to look different.
Yeah, I think this is one of those movies where the writers read one issue of Popular Science that happened to have active camouflage gene therapy and satellites that can be used as mirrors, and decided that all of those were plot elements.
Or they saw those three bullet points on the cover of a Popular Mechanics as they like walked past it or something. But yeah, the DNA. So at no point do they say like, "Oh, the DNA therapy thing is a good idea," because then like somebody could take your blood or your fingerprint to try and verify you're that other person, and then you wouldn't match because your DNA is different now. They're just like, "No, you're going to look different, and that'll be cool."
Yeah. Well, it also seems they provide a range of services here, because it doesn't seem like this doctor is bracing her to look or feel any different. Just younger, and better. But the services provided for, Colonel Moon and for Zhao are different from what seems to be going on with everybody else, where their ethnicity is being changed to visually represent some other ethnicity, which does not seem to be like what they generally do. But you don't really get a sense of that, I suppose. Anyway.
You just get to see a picture of what Zhao plans on looking like after he's done, and it looks like his name is going to be Scott by the time he's done, just because like he picked a Scott out of a book and was like, "Yeah, make me that guy."
Yeah, it's pretty sad. Halle Berry kills the doctor, goes through his files, finds the before and after photo. James Bond finds Zhao, and confronts him to try to find who the mole was. Probably should have just shot him in the head. But this enables Zhao to escape, but not before Bond can get the sort of bullet shell vial that's around Zhao's neck. And inside of it, he finds conflict diamonds, what we later learn are conflict diamonds. But that's this scene. And Zhao escapes onto a helicopter and leaves, and there's a big action scene, and Halle Berry's trying to shoot him, and Bond is trying to shoot him and blowing up a wall with, like, a canister of compressed air or something. And they're going after him. Then Halle Berry dives backwards off of the wall when the guards come after her. It is bad. It's not a good shot.
Amazing camera angle. It is amazing and iconic, just like the opening credits song.
Oh god, it's so bad. But she
not at all CG.
She dives down to the bottom, gets on the boat, and then waves and goes away, and no one fires a single round anywhere near her or at all. And the guards go their separate way from James Bond, who finds his way back to the mainland, no questions asked, which is interesting. But he goes back to the Scar guy, and the Scar guy is like, yes, we've done a chemical analysis. What lab? What lab is operating here? Anyway,
with his eyeballs.
They've done a chemical analysis, and that it is identical to conflict diamonds. And then James Bond points out, oh, but there's a laser etched insignia on the side. GG. And the guy says, oh, that's Gustav Graves. He's just started selling diamonds. It is really interesting that you would mention him. He sells them, and they're from Iceland. Isn't that interesting? And it's like, this is weird. Like, you guys all know this stuff from the scene. It's not organic or flowing in any way. But James Bond decides that he will go back to Europe now. And so he hops on a British Airways flight. And Deborah Moore, the daughter of former James Bond star Roger Moore, serves him a martini on the plane.
Oh, is that so?
Yes.
That's an Easter egg I missed. I was wondering why there was a whole scene where he was like, oh, look at this. We're on a wobbly airplane. Guess a good thing I ordered it shaken. Like,
yeah.
What? Okay.
It wasn't even, well, obviously they didn't put the set like on a gimbal or anything. So nothing was shaking except for the tray. So it just looked like she just couldn't hold the tray, unfortunately. But they didn't even shake the camera. But he got the martini. And of course, they're playing London Calling because there's literally nothing else you would do if you were having a character fly to London than play London Calling. You have to. I think it's a legal requirement for collecting certain tax subsidies. But they do this. And
at least they're going back to London. Like most of the time, he's in random other countries.
Yeah. It's good to take it home, I guess. So he lands and decides.
Take him home. Country road.
A little different. So he lands and gets to the fencing club. And then we start with, I don't know, one of the most nonsensical scenes. Where
you missed the part where Gustav Graves does his dramatic entrance where he parachutes into Buckingham Palace to be knighted.
Ugh, yes,
because he's very rich, and he went from an unknown a year ago to being a billionaire. So now that means he's worthy of knighthood, and he parachutes in, and we meet Miranda Frost, his assistant, who's sassing some reporter.
Yeah.
But then he walks very quickly and has a very weird fake smile.
Yes. And he's played by Toby Stevens, who I have not seen in anything else.
He's in that what do you call it movie with Jim from The Office? The war movie.
Sicario.
No, oh my god, what the hell was it? 13 Hours, the Benghazi movie.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Oh, that's not good.
I mean, he's a soldier.
Yeah, but like Michael Bay.
Right, that Benghazi. Is a Michael Bay movie.
Yeah.
Everybody's got big beards. They're all sweaty. Stuff blows up.
Meh. All right, so back to this movie. And, of course, the publicist Miranda Frost is played by Rosamund Pike. Who would go on to do better things than this. But here she is, and being frosty as ever, as they hop into their Range Rover or Discovery or whatever it is and peel out of there. And Bond is revealed to be in the crowd. Then they go to the fencing scene at the fencing club, and Bond introduces himself to Verity, who is Madonna, and he's talking about Gustav Graves, and she's like, oh, no, that's not Gustav Graves. That's my... It's my advanced student, my protege, Miranda Frost, his publicist. And Miranda Frost is revealed to be one of the people fencing. And James Bond is, I guess, incredibly turned on by this. But then he gets into a situation where he's going to fence with Gustav Graves, and it starts off as like a simple little fencing match, and then they're like, okay, well, let's just, you know, draw blood from the torso
and ramp it up a little bit. $1,000 a point. How about we just cut each other in the torso with swords?
Yeah, just go old school. And so then they rampage through the fencing club, destroying all kinds of stuff. And Madonna says she will have no part of this. And then they finally get down to the bottom where they're in a garden and there's a fountain and James Bond slashes Gustav Graves and he falls over into the fountain and then he gets back up again.
They've been spending the whole time like slicing each other up on the arms and the legs and the whatever, but yeah, he's the one who draws first blood from the torso, which means he wins, and he wagers one of his conflict diamonds, but since he wins, Gustav just like writes him a check.
Yeah, which is interesting to take a personal check on that occasion, but Gustav Graves is so impressed.
They didn't have Venmo back then.
Gustav Graves is so impressed that he invites Bond to the unveiling of Project Icarus, his latest thing. And he's, well, I should say that it's pretty transparent at this point that Gustav Graves is not only a villain, but a villain who knows James Bond and has it out for him. You may not necessarily assume that this is the dead son of the Korean general from the opening of the film, but... you at least know that there's something not on the up and up with him.
You mean by virtue of the fact that the first thing he says to James Bond is, have we met before, and waits to see what his response is?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
But James Bond gets a padded envelope that includes a key, and he has a quizzical look on his face before he goes to a bridge and then opens up a door and enters into an abandoned subway station.
It wouldn't be London without any sort of like secret underground ancient spy type place full of junk that can be used as Easter eggs from other movies and also have M and Q and have a car and some stupid crap.
Yeah. If anything, this reminds me of Skyfall a little, which it turns out that the writers on this wrote on Skyfall. So, oh boy.
There's secrets. There's catacombs and stuff underneath the city the whole time. You didn't even know.
Yeah. Yeah,
always. Everywhere you go, there are catacombs under the street full of spies.
Well, the rate they go through spies, I wouldn't doubt it. But he meets M, and M very confrontationally says that he was burned by somebody basically had said this thing, and so she like couldn't have him, and he's like, oh well. Now you want me back working for you because I'm onto this other stuff and you can't go after him. And she's like, yes, exactly that, for political reasons. And it seems like this is incredibly convoluted, but she is authorizing him to use all their stuff. So then he goes down and talks to John Cleese because Desmond Llewellyn is unfortunately no longer with us and had died between the last film and this. John Cleese walks him through the closet full of all of the other misguided props from previous Bond movies, including the jetpack and the crocodile that is used in Octopussy, where James Bond floats in a river as a crocodile and then gets out of the crocodile when he gets to the other side of the river. So that is a thing that's there that you could look at. But that lets you know kind of, I think, the tone that someone on this production was striving for, even though if it wasn't everybody else.
This is site B for Q or whatever. Like, this is where they keep all the old crap because it's the basement that used to be a subway station. So yeah.
B for Q.
They can hang on to the old stuff.
I prefer BBQ. That's not very British. But
what kind of wood chips do you like for your barbecue?
Oh, I don't even get that specific. I have a very strong opinion about proteins.
Oh, do you?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Pulled pork.
Oh, so boring.
I like pulled pork. I don't like
brisket.
It's
frequently dry and not really that flavorful.
Pulled pork is frequently juicy and very flavorful, and brisket is frequently dry and not that flavorful.
Nope. It's delicious.
No.
You're wrong. You're backwards and wrong.
See, you and Jason agree on this one, and I disagree.
See, and I even go with lean brisket these days too, because oftentimes it is more flavorful, even though it is ostensibly slightly drier, but it is still better tasting.
Nope.
It is.
Nope, you're wrong.
First of all, there's nothing better than ribs, but it's very easy to do ribs wrong, and you got to be skeptical when you're getting ribs. But on the whole, briskets, all things being equal, briskets better than pulled pork.
I don't like ribs.
Of course you don't, because you get stuff on your hands.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, you get stuff on your hands, and you gotta like eat around a bone. I don't like it.
You don't have to eat around the bone. You just bite it and pull. Well, this is the same as your chicken wing aversion too.
Yes, I don't like the chicken wings either. Don't make fun of me, because you eat chicken nuggets covered in barbecue sauce. So don't laugh at me.
Sometimes. I prefer regular chicken wings, but you know, Domino's doesn't have those. Well, they do, but I don't want to eat them. Chicken wings from, like, actual chicken wings with a bone in them from Domino's are just basically like a bone covered in gelatin and a little bit of sauce. And it's disgusting.
So you get the adult chicken nuggets then?
What are adult chicken nuggets?
Well, I just mean that in terms of it is a breaded piece of chicken that has been fried and then covered in sauce.
I think you're talking about a boneless wing.
Yeah, because that was definitely a wing.
Yeah.
And not from a different part of the bird.
Yeah. No, I prefer regular wings, but from select places.
Okay. So, anyway, pulled pork is the best. Moving on.
It's not.
They have him get all this stuff where it's a ring that has a high-frequency glass-breaking thing. This is important because it lets you know that James Bond will be able to break all the safety glass through the rest of the movie.
He's going to break a couple pieces of safety glass.
And
one windshield, one floor.
Both of them had it coming. And he's also introduced to having another watch, and then the VR simulation of an invasion of MI6 where Samantha Bond's Moneypenny is shot dead in the head, and he has to follow Colin whatever his face is over to try to get Judi Dench and Colin the shot, and then he tries to rescue Judi Dench by shooting her through the shoulder to get to the other guy, and then you find out it's a simulation and John Cleese walks through and you're like, oh wow, VR, this is amazing,
and you're like, oh wow, what was point here?
No point. This is a bad scene. This is an incredibly bad scene. There is also another bad VR scene in this movie much later, but this sets that one up, so I guess that's why they needed to have them both. But I would have cut both of them entirely from the film and you would not have felt any differently about it.
You would have said like, hey, this 2-hour and 13-minute movie is slightly shorter.
they go to unveil his car, and it is like this little trolley thing comes up on the streetcar line that's empty, and John Cleese hits a button and reveals that it is that Aston Martin calls it the Vanquish, but they call it the Vanish because it has active camouflage, and so there are tiny little cameras and panels that can project the image from the other side so that to the casual eye it will appear like it's invisible. Unfortunately, they basically just did like the Predator effect, but with CG, and it was like very, I don't know, Viper the TV show. It's not a convincing thing. They didn't really give you the sense of what active camouflage would look like with this, and it looks silly in that regard.
Yeah, it's fine. It's the James Bond gadget element in the movie that I'm okay with because it's a James Bond movie and it's stupid.
Well, I mean, it is probably one of the sillier things. But he takes that to Iceland, where he will go to the opening of Project Icarus, and he arrives in his car and is followed immediately by a jet-propelled skiff? What I don't know what you call that.
I don't know. It's a rocket car for...
Yeah.
This movie is just full of the dumbest rich guy sports that you can imagine. You got fencing. You got, again, also slicing each other up with real swords for money. You got racing across glaciers with jet-powered thingamabobs. You got parachuting. It's very rich and stupid.
Yes, very rich and stupid. But I like I do like the Vanquish.
Oh, it's a beautiful car.
I thought it was a beautiful car at the time, and I still think it's a beautiful car. It's quite the looker. Unfortunately, they didn't quite refresh it and keep it up to date, do good stuff with it. But I mostly blame Ford for that, because this is, of course, during Ford's ownership of Aston Martin. This also explains why several of the other cars you see are also Ford owned, including Jaguar and the Thunderbird that shows up. That Halle Berry tracks the Thunderbird.
Thunderbird is so stupid. That was such a bad car for them to make. But Jaguar and Aston Martin—they're both British cars, so they work in there for the casual eye. I am a big fan of that generation of Aston Martins as well. They're very attractive cars. And what's his name? Jake Gyllenhaal. Drives a DB9, or at least he used to. He looked like that.
Well, that's nice. I would like one.
Yeah. He parked it outside Pizzeria Mozza one time. You could run into him there.
Well, hopefully I don't. A DB9 would be very expensive for me.
No, don't. Literally. He just parked in the valley.
Well, choose
right
your
there.
Words carefully, Dan. I think this is on you. So
I said run into him, not the car.
Well, that's even worse. Injury insurance.
No, you could do like a clumsy thing where you come out the door at the same time he's trying to go in, and you like run into each other.
Oh, that's good. I'm sure he'll really like me. He'll look me right in the eyes, right in the scowly, hard-browed eyes, and just be like, "Yes, I love that you ran into me with your pizza."
Well, he'll look at you in the nose because you're taller than he is.
Oh, that's true.
Remember that episode of Mystery Show or whatever, when they tracked down how tall he was?
No.
You didn't listen to Mystery Show on Gimlet before it got canceled?
No.
For being too good?
Wait, what? Is any of this real that you're saying right now?
It is. No, apparently there's a lot of debate online about the height of celebrities. Apparently there was a very contentious argument on the internet for years and years about exactly how tall he is, because he reported a certain height, and then other people have all this photo evidence and are like, no, he's standing next to this, he can't be that tall, he's got to be this tall. And the host of Mystery Show compared all that information.
Oh, Mystery
and
Show
tracked him down to find out how tall he was. Yes, Mystery Show.
I thought you said Mr. Show.
No, Mr. Jake Gyllenhaal on Mr. Show would be quite good as well.
Well, no, but that's why I was so confused, because I thought you were talking about like some sort of Mr. Show revival that was on Gimlet. I knew about Mystery Show.
There was a Mr. Show revival, but it was called just with Bob David.
Okay. But anyway, what was the conclusion on his height?
Oh, he's like 5'9" or something.
Oh, he's so short.
Something like that. You'd have to go look it up again. He's not 6 feet. He's not 6'3" or whatever the hell the online thing said he was. But he's 5 and then some double digits maybe.
I mean, I always thought I was taller than him, but like I thought he was
You're
like
taller than a lot of people though average.
I thought he was like 6 foot or 5'11" or something.
Close, but I don't think so.
No,
I mean, I guess I'm sitting here in front of a computer, so I could probably just Google it.
I don't know. It sounds really hard to do that right now, Dan. I don't want to like push you on.
Oh, 5'11" is what this says. The world now knows Jake Gyllenhaal's real height. Oh yeah, I forgot. So not only did he do the Mystery Show thing, he went on Conan, and
it still says like you're saying Mr. Show.
Mystery Show.
Yeah, you just gotta work on that mystery. Yes.
Anyway, Starley Kine showed up on Conan as well, and he came out. She says that he claims to be 5'11 and a half, but she didn't have any proof, so then he comes out, and they like grab a measuring tape and measure him, but they don't do it precisely or anything.
Mm. Exciting.
So anyway, 5'11 and a half is what he says.
All right. Well, then that's tall enough. All right, so they have this thing where they're parking the cars. The valet, Mr. Kill, introduces himself. And that's Kill with one eye, and he has an interesting style thing going on. He is not a Bond villain that anyone should remember, and I, in fact, did not remember him when I went to watch this movie again. He had escaped my mind entirely.
And I didn't remember that either.
Yeah, he's there. And they have the thing of him parking the car, and what's his name, Ivan? He's the guy who seems to be the gadget whatever for our evil Gustav Graves, and so he's recording the time.
You always gotta have like a random guy with a weird foreign accent who works on your gadgets.
Yeah, he's a little Igor-ish in terms of his accent, but he's recording.
He reminds me of you never saw any of the Mission Impossible movies. Never mind.
He's recording the times for the jet car thing and whatever, and they talk about the device, blah blah blah. He goes off. Bond and Gustav exchange pleasantries or whatever, and then Bond goes inside, and there is what I can only describe as Mr. Freeze's hotel. Inside it is a Joel Schumacher Batman and Robin set in there. It is ridiculous. I don't know who thought that this was a good idea, but they were wrong. This is an ice palace constructed of ice, but it's
a thing. I don't think on that scale, but it's a thing that they do. People make hotels out of ice.
No, they do, but they're usually like squatter structures, and also not lit like this, and seemingly of like dubiously not ice. But the thing here that we're seeing looks very much like it came from like a rejected Mr. Freeze set from Batman and Robin. This doesn't really, especially with you when you get to the ice skating waitresses and all that at the party later, that's just goofy. James Bond orders his martini, and he says plenty of ice if you can spare it. For
they got a good deal on acrylic basically, and they just went to town.
Did they ever. Miranda Frost is there, and they exchange their stuff, and at this point it's revealed that Miranda Frost is actually an MI6 agent, but that she's undercover, and she's worried that Bond will blow her cover, and she insists to M prior to this mission that there's nothing dirty on Gustav that she's been able to find. And I don't know if M seems suspect of her or just that she's not turned up anything is just in general not good. But in any way, they all three of them are there exchanging their innuendos with one another that don't even seem like they would fit in a conversation. It's just sort of like, just say everything that could be an ice pun. Again, echoing sort of a Joel Schumacher Batman and Robin vibe. Before Bond excuses himself, and they watch like the thing with the whatever mystery satellite blast thing, and like, oh, we can put sun anywhere on the globe. Isn't that great?
Yeah, the Icarus, the whole thing, the product launch happens, and it's another satellite that does some stupid stuff because it's a James Bond movie, and you got to have a bad guy with a satellite. It's a big mirror. It's a mirror that reflects the sun onto the dark side of the earth, and it's built out of sails. Silver type sail things.
Yeah. Of all of the James Bond satellites that I've seen over the years, this one's the least bad, but it's still not great. So I don't know what that says necessarily. I can't think of a James Bond satellite I would rank higher than this one, but it's still not good.
Well, also, this satellite appears to have another satellite nearby it with a camera on it, so everyone down on Earth can see it.
I'm sure he just rents that from another company.
Richard Branson, maybe.
Yeah, Richard Branson's like, yeah, sure, I'll show your solar sail thing. Also, they don't seem to put a lot of effort into the fact that he needs to coordinate the angle of this thing in order for it to do any of the stuff that it does. It's just sort of like, yes, and then all of a sudden a laser blast. But he uses this to put sunlight on them, and they all have sunglasses, and they put them on. And it's revealed that during this demonstration that there are three incredibly suspicious people over on the side that James Bond keeps eyeing, and Halle Berry disappears during it. James Bond makes his way into the secret whatever lair home of Gustav. At this point, it's revealed that Gustav and Zhao know each other, and Gustav is like, yes, you know, we had to go through this, but I can't sleep anymore, and this is the way that you'll be able to do it too. And he's like 2 inches from his face, and it's like, are you guys lovers? Like, why aren't you kissing? Like, I don't know why you would get that close to another person's face. But they do apparently like exchanged this whole thing where he's like, yeah, sure, go ahead. And so Zhao uses the face rejuvenation thing, but it's unclear exactly what that's going to do since he never really got the, like the full gene therapy.
It helps him nap better, I think.
Yes. But
he calls it the dream machine.
Yeah. It just seems very hard to sleep if you're going to be blasting like fiber optic glowy light in my eyes, but maybe that's soothing after a while with the swirly patterns. But James Bond breaks in sort of to the compound by using his car and parking his car there. And then there's a guard who speaks entirely in ADR German. and the guard is incapacitated. Like there's his lips don't move. There's not a single line of dialogue, but he incapacitates the guard and then spins a wheel thing that shoots.
Exhaust vent. There's a tube. There's a wheel. There's a big sign that says, do not turn this wheel without proper, I don't know, pressure regulation. It's like a paragraph long. It's just like, oh, if I spin this a certain way, it'll blast debris and steam out and knock over the guards, and then I can escape casually.
Yes, it seems so specifically targeted as a device, and yet there's nothing about the specific targeting of that device that is displayed there. It is just like, yeah, this is going to be bad if you do this. And so he's like, okay. And so he does
he just waits till they walk into the approximate range of this giant tube. And cranks the wheel and it blasts him.
But then he makes his escape. And then he runs into Rosamund Pike in the, like, I don't know, valet parking lot. And they start making out because...
He's like, you're going to get caught. I'm here to help you not get caught. So let's make out so the guards just think we're making out. Because that's a trope in all spy movies. Like, they're searching this, like, very specific area for somebody. And they come across somebody, but then they, like, happen to be making out with somebody else. And they're like, couldn't have been that guy. He's over here busy with a lady.
Yeah. Also, I have to say that it's unclear to me what her motive is in this scene, because we know later that she's not actually working for MI6, and that her whole plan all along is to basically have him killed for her evil lover thing. So
maybe
I don't know.
She wants him to get killed and caught, but maybe just not yet for some reason.
Maybe she just wanted to screw him first. I don't know.
She could have captured him and then done it that way too.
Rapier. She has the whole thing about like sex for dinner and death for breakfast or whatever that she says. Maybe she's like, I want some dinner. And so they go up to his suite and he's like, oh, well, you should stay here to sell the illusion of us being together. And it's like, ugh.
Yeah. And she's like, okay, good point. Immediately drops her dress. So maybe you're right.
Yeah. I mean, I can only imagine that she was just like, I want to screw him before we kill this guy. But she gets into bed with him and he puts his gun under the pillow. And of course, as we know from Tomorrow Never Dies, tell me, James, do you still sleep with a gun under your pillow? So he does still. And I'm sure Paris would be elated to find that out.
Occupational hazard or something, isn't that what he says?
Yeah, he says occupational hazard. And she's like, oh. And then, anyway, they screw. She disarms the gun, of course, and we see, like, a protracted shot of her, like, manipulating her hands in the air for no reason. It's like, there's some gun bullets in that.
James Bond, career... world-class spy can't tell the difference between the weight of a loaded gun and an unloaded gun, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, they're light as air, really. Yes? No?
Bullets or guns?
Yes, both. I would assume
totally, yeah, sure. You definitely can't tell in your hand. No, you can tell. If you're holding a gun, you can tell if it's empty or not.
So she disarms his gun. He goes to rescue Halle Berry. Well, not really. He goes to break in. He doesn't know that Halle Berry's in trouble. And
that's a very circular hole in the ice with his laser watch.
Which is kind of hilarious, actually, because there's a laser scene going on at the same time. The laser scene with Halle Berry, of course, mimics the laser scene with Goldfinger, the infamous laser scene. No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die. And then he's like shooting a laser up his crotch. But in this case, it's from the side towards her face, slowly. This is a bad way to kill anybody. Not because of the mess or anything, but just because it takes forever.
Mr. Kill wanted to cut her up with the laser because he was, he wanted to have a good time. He couldn't really cut loose at the party.
Yes. He was on duty earlier, and he finally can let his hair down. Bond breaks in. There's a fight. Halle Berry's rescued, and there's more fighting, and there's lasers all over the place. There's that one scene where they hits the button, and there's a bajillion lasers that turn all at the same time, and it's just what is going on?
Laser disco. Yeah, it's fun because not only are the lasers going all over the place, but the table thing she's strapped to moves around too, because it's also attached to a industrial robot from a car factory.
Yes, this is just all too much. But the laser is eventually used by Bond to zap Mr. Kill through his mouth to the back of his head, thus killing Mr. Kill. And Bond and Halle Berry escape. They go their separate ways where Bond reveals that Zhao is blah, blah, blah. And then she reveals that whatever. And then he's like, and she's like, oh, and we got to tell our governments and whatever, and they'll get backup. And he says, yeah, but save Miranda Frost first. She's MI6. And so she goes to do that. And then he goes up to the office and then hides behind the Icarus thingy. Having full access to it open could have, broken it. But I guess
destroyed
he
destroyed it.
Yeah, I guess he didn't really realize what a threat it was at the time, since it hadn't been used as a laser to kill anybody yet.
It's relatively obvious, though, that it's going to be a bad guy thing operated by a bad guy.
Yes. I mean, I feel like it's just a general rule. Break all of the bad guy's stuff.
Break his stuff.
Yeah. You don't need to oh, well, what if I need to use this later? No, just break it. Because there's not a single moment where that doesn't work for him. At the beginning of this movie, he, shoots some push button pad that controls the concrete lentil pillar situation that blockades the North Korean facility, and that causes it to automatically close and crash all of the pursuing hover car vehicles. And then later in the film, people shoot other stuff and it causes it to break in exactly the kinds of ways that they would want it to. So just break everything.
Also, spoiler for the end of the movie, when he goes into the jet turbine and crushes the controller, the satellite turns off, which probably not how that would work, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean, that's James Bond logic. But going by James Bond logic, then James Bond should just destroy all of this guy's stuff, because then he can't
use
it. Yeah. But anyway, he has a confrontation, and he says that he recognizes him because he's the son of the general, and the guy's like, oh, I thought you were going to never guess, blah, blah, blah. And this is when Rosamund Pike comes in, and she has a gun, and she has it pointed at Gustav Graves, and then there's some conversation stuff, and then the gun shifts to James Bond, and he's like, oh, no, and then he realizes his gun isn't loaded, oh, no. And then he realizes that he's been betrayed. Oh, no. And then she's got him now. And they disarm him from all of his toys.
She was the one who betrayed him in North Korea and got him kidnapped for 18 months and tortured or whatever. But yeah, right. He's got it all sorted out now. And then he makes fun of Zhao. And Zhao's like, how dare you? And punches him in the gut. So he has an excuse to keel over and put his hand on the ground and use his little supersonic ring to shatter the floor, because they're standing on a lair that's elevated above the ground, and the floor is glass.
Yes. I mean, I would personally use plexiglass, but whatever. I don't know. I don't know what the Iceland building codes are for ice palaces and geodesic domes attached. But he breaks the glass safety glass floor and then falls through with Rosamund Pike and other people, and then he runs off while being shot at, and Halle Berry is locked up in a hotel room to melt, because the place is going to melt from the laser, but that's going to be laser. Don't worry about
that. She's not super high stakes or whatever, so they're going to kill her by just locking her in an ice room and letting the whole place crash, which, if you thought the ice building was dumb earlier, it's even stupider when they start pointing Icarus at it and it's melting. Because basically, the room that Halle Berry is trapped in just fills up with water like it's a swimming pool, and ostensibly she kind of drowns. Well, there's a car chase occurring inside of the leaky, drippy ice castle.
You're skipping over the best part of this movie.
Am I?
By the best, I mean the worst. Because Bond takes the rocket car.
Yes, of course. It's also never a James Bond movie if, like, he finds himself in a precarious situation and he has to escape, he has to run away from the building as fast as possible in a very weird way. And then very shortly thereafter, he has to go right back to where he came from in a very weird way. So he runs away from Gustav to escape so he doesn't get killed. And then he takes out a guard and takes his snowmobile and goes right back where he was.
Yes. And
in between there is, I believe, the scene you were going to describe.
Yes. He's in the rocket car. And then Gustav Graves shows him the firepower of this fully armed and operational Icarus satellite, where a laser slowly pursues him across the ground. Now, if James Bond is moving in a straight line at a high speed, you would think that you could be like, hey, maybe I could just shoot in front of him instead of just behind him the entire time.
Well, it's a very fast ice sled, so I think he's running faster than the satellite is capable of turning.
Yeah, just turn it off, then turn it, and then turn it back on again. But whatever.
Turn it off, turn it on.
Yeah. Clap on, clap off. So they laser blast after him the whole entire way until he gets to an ice cliff, and he goes over it with this, I don't know, clamp on whatever thing.
He ejects the anchor, so it hooks on the edge.
Yeah, and it hooks on the edge. He's dangling over the side. He gets the parachute out of the back that we saw earlier that was used as the brake when he was going to the valet. And he gets the cover for the parachute broken off so that he can surf on it. And he parasail surfs down to the water. And there is an incredibly long bad scene of Pierce Brosnan on a green screen pretending to like sort of windsurf with the air brake of the weird chute that he has in conjunction with all of the body movements to try to move the little board thing he's standing on that's sort of weirdly shaped. Anyway, he's out of there, and then he gets back up to to ice, and then uses the parachute to clothesline somebody who's coming by in a snowmobile because he's, I guess, memorized the routes of patrol vehicles. I don't know why he would know where this guy was going to be.
It would have been real funny if the guy had gone around the other side of the glacier and he's like, oh, you came around behind me. Sorry, I was trying to straighten out my parachute over here.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's also weird because they know they have to get him back over a great distance to the ice palace because he left over a great distance from the ice palace. So he can't do that on foot for the timetable that they have. So they have him go back on this snowmobile, and he arrives as they're ready to take off in their plane and use Project Icarus to melt the hotel. And there's a weird scene with Halle Berry and Rosamund Pike where, for no reason,
she shows up at the door and is like, well, you're going to die. Also, I had sex with James Bond, too. And he's going to die also. Have fun. Bye. And
yes.
She closes the door again.
It's a strange taunt. But
it makes no sense at all. No. It doesn't even really buy anybody any time, really. Well, I guess it really does is illustrate to Halle Berry that she's not like accidentally locked in the hotel. Like the door didn't just jam because it's a crappy ice hotel. Like she's there because they're trying to kill her.
Yeah. It also illustrates to Halle Berry that Rosamund Pike is not great. So when she kills Rosamund Pike later, that nobody feels bad. But organically in the course of this film, it's very strange.
Oh, yeah, I guess she probably did need some scene where she meets her and they sass each other before they get together later and fight, rather than just that very casual encounter at the bar earlier.
Yes, yes. And all the yo mama stuff, whatever. But she gets locked into this room, Rosamund Pike and Gustav leave on the plane with Ivan. Bond gets back and uses his car, which has the active camouflage on still, to go into the facility, and he's like blowing up stuff, and Zhao's there, and Zhao hops into a Jag, and there's a machine gun on that Jag, and they're just duking it out.
It has all the comparable weaponry. It has a big machine gun. It's got missiles. It's got what's the extremely specifically labeled button on the dash that shows him like the heat signature of the car, so he can see him when he's camouflaged.
I forgot the label for that one, but yes, it's strange. It's one of those things where it's just like, well, that was really useful active camouflage, wasn't it? But
yeah, if you're a bad guy, you gotta have a button to detect camouflage cars. That's just what you do.
Yeah, I mean, everybody does. It's one of those, you know, things that people generally look for in this line of work, which is why James Bond was completely surprised by it earlier. But
you got to get the fully loaded vehicle, because otherwise you pull up next to somebody else and they got the more loaded vehicle. And even though you get a nice Jag that's got machine guns and rockets, you're going to feel bad that you don't have the invisible car detecting button.
Yeah, they have the infrared installed to the factory. So he had no choice but to get that one.
You got the EX, you got the LX, then you got the one with the active camouflage detection.
Yeah, the touring.
The touring package, exactly.
So
or the grand touring package in this case, maybe.
He pulls out of there, and they're chasing each other, shooting at each other, and there's car stuff, and like flipping over, and like using ejector seats to flip cars back on top, and then stuff, rockets, and shooting, and RPG grenade things out the back, but the things that shot the manual shoot the things. And so anyway, all that stuff goes
on.
Yeah, but then James Bond's like, oh no, they're melting the ice palace. I know that Halle Berry is still inside. So he decides he's got to go back there. He drives into the building, knocking out two snowmobile dunces on his way in, drives through the lobby, which is melting, quote unquote, by water spraying down from hoses in the ceiling. And
it's like the Universal Studios like subway thing that they have that's like built to flood, only everything's made out of acrylic.
Yeah, this is just very, very Batman and Robin. So he drives up into there, and Zhao chases after him, and there's like a car chase battle thing in the lobby, and then through the halls, and then finally Bond gets his car wedged in a certain way, and then uses the active camouflage, and Zhao doesn't realize it and drives.
Yeah, Zhao's going to ram him with the 6-foot spikes that came out of the front of his car where his engine should be. But no, he's also got like big I-beam girder spikes that come out. And right as he starts driving at Bond, he turns back on his active camouflage, which has healed itself, and turns on his tire spikes. So he can use his extra tread to basically drive up a wall, which I guess is kind of like a 45-degree angle, maybe a little bit steeper. And then Zhao basically just drives straight through the wall into like a miniature lagoon that has formed in the lobby of the hotel. And then James Bond quickly drives past and uses his gun to shoot a giant chandelier from the ceiling that comes crashing down on Zhao's face, killing him.
Yeah, and it's especially silly.
Not convoluted or complicated at all.
No. This is very straightforward. This is what happens all the time.
See bad guy, kill bad guy with, you know, spiky chandelier.
It was ice to meet you. But the bad news, unfortunately, is that they chose to retime this scene, as they chose to retime several other scenes in this film. And this one is probably the most egregious because there's a car flipping in midair that they're retiming. And so you're watching like the entire lobby ripple as this car is slowly turning because they're trying to interpolate in between frames. And they didn't paint for errors in that interpolation. They just said, oh, well, the computer did it, and then just left it as it was, I guess.
See, computer really does make the visual effects, doesn't it?
No. I don't think people understand. There are so many retime artifacts that can occur when you're trying to adjust the speed of something, especially when you're trying to slow something down that is a high, that is something that is fast moving that has motion blur, because then you just have this smeary thing that has no detail. So you can't really slow that down very much. And it's also occluding a lot of the stuff behind it because it's so smeary. But this is what you have here. all the stuff in the lobby just starts to distort and wiggle and deform as the car spins like in a corkscrew fashion through the lobby in quote unquote slow motion. So I hate that. I also hate like the cape twirl scene that Zhao does earlier, but this one is just especially egregious because it is so starkly visible as being an error that I don't know how it was ever considered like, yes, this is final, it's done. Because this is not the kind of thing you need to like pause on. You can see this in motion as it's occurring. It's so bad. Anyway, it just agitates me. As somebody who's had to like clean up retime errors before, but Bond goes and finds the room that Halle Berry's in using, I don't know, the display detector that shows a red dot where Halle Berry is, his Halle Berry detector, and his baryometer, and he uses that to find where she is, break the door, all the water floods out, she plops onto the windshield, he uses the ring thing to break the windshield to pull her in and then drive out of there as fast as possible before the whole thing collapses. And then he resuscitates her and they decide to go to the demilitarized zone. Cut to demilitarized zone, where we get more Michael Madsen, which we were just like, I've had too much Michael Madsen, to be perfectly honest with you, for this film.
Never too much. I mean, you either have a second of Michael Madsen is enough Michael Madsen for most people. Either that or you really like Michael Madsen.
I don't like. I especially in this. He's
kind of cilantro-y as an actor. You either, like, you can tolerate a really tiny amount of him or anything more is way too much.
I mean, I like him in Reservoir Dogs. End of list. I don't want to see him. I don't want to see him here.
What about the Kills Bill?
No. That whole thing is just... so bad. I don't like it.
Okay.
We'll do that. We'll do that one of these days. We'll talk about my feelings on Kill Bill and how much I deeply dislike Kill Bill Volume 2. But they have this blah thing that occurs where they go to the demilitarized zone. M is there for reasons. And Colin, what's his face? And they're all talking about the severity of the situation that they found themselves in. They have tracked the plane that what's his face landed in, Gustav Graves landed in. And there's North
the
Korean
giant,
officials.
737 or whatever that he landed on the ice in Iceland and then took back off with is now in North Korea. And they,
I think
they
it's a 747.
Whatever it is, it's massive.
Well, and they're like, 737 is not massive. 737 is a Southwest Airlines flight. 747 is the big one. And it has two floors, which is what you would need for this, for the pilot thing, and then for the weird
the
nose
pilot
cone.
Is wedged in such a strange place. And when it's two stories, the pilot's always on the top. And in this instance, they put the pilot on the bottom, it looked like.
I think he was on the top.
I don't know.
I think he was on a top.
She's dead.
But they're like, yeah, here's very distinctive jet airplane that he bought with all of his conflict diamond money over the past 18 months, I guess. But they tracked that, and they're like, we can't really do anything because we don't want to provoke anything.
Draw this out so long. It's so dumb. Like, they're like, we're here to make sure it doesn't get any worse. And James Bond's like, I'm going in there, even if you can't. And Michael Madsen's like, I'm not letting you go in there by yourself. Halle Berry, you better go with him. And it's like, you just spent 5 minutes doing exactly what we knew you were going to do the whole time, which is send them there to go do stuff. But then they don't send them there to like go straight in and like shut them down. Like, there's a whole protracted sniper scene where they're hiding in the weeds and Jinx is like being his spotter, like telling him to adjust the windage on his scope, and he's trying to assassinate, it looks like he's trying to assassinate Miranda, but she's standing next to Gustav kinda, but then like there's trucks in the way because they're laying on the ground. They didn't get an elevated position. And then it's like, darn, we missed our shot. The plane's about to take off. We better sprint down this runway, which is now empty, even though it was full of trucks and like shipping containers 5 seconds ago. But we're just going to run down this undetected and jump in through the landing gear and sneak our way onto the plane.
Yes.
It takes forever. It's so dumb. We knew they were going to end up on the plane.
Yeah, this movie takes forever for everything. I don't know why that is. And it's strange because it seems to make you want to believe that all of this is dramatic, but when it's going on for so long, it really isn't, because none of this stuff is really supposed to take this long to go through, that they try to stretch out so much. But they get on the plane and they realize, oh, we're in a cargo hold. Isn't that amazing? And they identify several cars and a helicopter, and then they go.
What were the cars?
Lamborghini and Ferrari.
You are correct. There was a yellow Ferrari. I forget which one that one was. It kind of looked like a Testarossa, and the Lamborghini was a Diablo.
Mm-hmm. I recognize the one of them had a hood thing.
A hood thing.
A hood thing on the hood, like a logo, to say like, oh, hey, this is a brand.
Well, sure. Ferrari has a horse. Lamborghini has a bull.
Yes, for the tractors. But they have everybody go inside, and this is when little British boy is explaining to all the Korean generals, including his kidnapped father, that. He's not a little British boy, that he is really the Korean guy that we saw from the beginning of the film. And it's not...
It's like the fourth time we see General Daddy just kind of standing around in the corner staring with like a furrowed brow. He's like there. He's there when Icarus is launched. He's brought in later for a private meeting in Gustav's little quarters before James Bond breaks the floor. And then he's here. And he's just sort of standing there staring. Like, he's going along on a lot of... meet and greet type stuff, and he doesn't really seem to have any idea why he's there until a little British boy is like, hey, I'm your son. And he's like, no, you're not. My son's dead. And he's like, no, I'm really your son. We're going to take over the world now. And he's like, oh, you are my son, but you're not my son because you're evil.
It's really dumb. And also, when he had initially died or thought was dead, he had said some ridiculous stuff to James Bond where he's like, oh, my son. You know, I sent him away to Oxford and stuff, and so he was, you know, trained in the decadent ways and whatever. He was a little weird, basically is his way of saying it. And here it's reflected that he doesn't fully endorse his own son. And this rejection is not doesn't sit well with Gustav. So he gives...
You know, I just realized that even up to the point that we've been talking now and for years, I always thought Zhao was his brother. Zhao's not his brother, is he?
No.
Huh.
Yeah. He's someone who works for him and maybe a friend. But I swear to God, when they're in that scene where they're like 2 inches from each other's face, I was like, just kiss.
That's why I thought they were like, you know, he's like an older brother or at most like a cousin or something. Like, it's the family business or whatever. But he doesn't have any connections to General Uncle Daddy or whatever.
No connections. But the general did seem to want to trade him for James Bond. So I don't know if he had some connection. But they go through this whole thing of the plane taking off, and they're all on it, and things are going crappy. Because the general is with the three other Korean generals who had been at the demonstration and who are on board with this situation, who want to use Icarus against South Korea and to control the world. And Michael Madsen had said earlier that, we got a rocket that we fired up there, a big ol' ICBM that we're going to blow up that satellite with. And this is where it's revealed that the rocket is going to be disintegrated by the satellite blasting the sun at it a lot. And then everybody's like, oh, wow, that's great. And there's some protracted stuff with feeling up Statue's face and then feeling up the genetically modified face of his son and then being like, you're not my son, blah, blah, blah. And then there's the hug of death where Gustav turns on the zappy zap on his big VR suit and zaps his own dad to death with the 10,000 volt security system or whatever that's on it.
100,000 volts.
100,000 volt security system that's on it. So he dies. And then Bond wanders in, but he's obstructed by somebody who comes in the door, and so the shot goes off through the window. Halle Berry had taken over the plane and was flying it fine until then, and is like, oh crap, and then she's trying to compensate for that. She compensates, but then Rosamund Pike wanders in her sports bra. And
yeah, very, very unusual outfit, some high-waisted white pants and a very weird top bra thing.
It is basically a bra. Like, that's not a top. I don't understand how
it's
that
her,
could
it's
be
her sword fighting get up.
her sword fighting bra. Like that is not a, that's not a full outfit. That's not a shirt. Anyway,
she's on vacation. She's on a plane.
I mean, I know that people on a plane like to dress casual, but I can't imagine anybody just being like, oh, well, time to relax. Here's my chest and, my torso completely except for the front of my breast area.
Oh yeah. And don't forget she has, like gloves on that go all the way up to her bicep that match her bra thing.
Yes. Cause those are the fencing gloves.
Sure.
It is preposterous. I don't understand why anyone would say that this would be an outfit to put anybody in, but Halle Berry is also wearing a tank top. So it's not great for anybody. And they have a very long sword fight scene when the plane goes on autopilot, and Halle Berry locks the autopilot into the path of the laser that's going towards South Korea. So that it'll blow up the plane, I guess. But before that, they fight a lot with knives and swords and stuff for a long time. And apparently the whole reason why Rosamund Pike was won over to what's-his-face's side is because he OD'd the other opponent on steroids. I don't know how one ODs on steroids in a tournament, but he did that to the person to benefit her, and she won the thing. Now, I'm going to say that no one should ever try to cheat for someone they care about, especially not in a way that could be traced back to you and that you could be charged with crimes for. I just feel like that is a situation that I should raise a red flag about.
I feel like you're being very specific about something in particular.
No, nothing in particular.
Are you sure? It sounds like something very specific that you're talking about.
No, just everybody just be really committed to doing the right thing. You know, you want to put in your own work and don't have somebody else do it for you.
Well, for what it's worth, I'm familiar with the mechanics of this sword fight battle. I do not remember her saying anything about Gustav Graves ODing the competitor to help her win.
Oh,
no matter how many times I've ever seen it.
He says it when they're in Ice
says
Palace.
It. Okay. I don't remember that either, because apparently it is irrelevant and stupid.
Yeah, because he says, like, oh, we both have something in common, winning, which is why I was able to, you know.
Right, doing whatever it takes to win or something.
Yeah, yeah. And
I remember that line. I don't remember anything else about it.
Yeah, he's like, and that's all it took to turn her. And he says this right in front of her, and it's just like, wouldn't that unturn her? Wouldn't she be like, you don't like own me necessarily. Like that's strange. But anyway, she feels owned, I guess, and so she's very happy about that. Downstairs in the glass nose cone section, everybody is being sucked out the window from the broken window, and I mean sucked out, like literally, like people are just flying out the window. All three of the generals are sucked out of there, and some of the other soldier guys, and it's just Bond and Gustav.
Yeah, like the foreign bomb maker guy who made the suit is like the first one to go out the window.
Yes, Ivan. It's just Bond and whatever his face is, and then when the plane levels off and everything is normalized, they have time to just say nonsense to each other for a while, which is not something I really think we needed. But he's got that suit, and Bond is like, oh no, what will I do? He's wearing a lot of plastic. But the plane flies through the laser, and this changes the calculus of everything because the plane catches on fire all over and on every surface. And then the plane slowly crashes to the earth for the next 3 years. And everyone on the plane is like, oh no, what were we going to do? We got to get off. And, Gustav is like, oh, here's two parachutes. Oh no, now there's one parachute. It's just for me. And so I'm going to go now. And so he, puts it on, and then he's like, I'm going to monologue right to your face. And James Bond just pulls the pin, and the chute expands and starts to suck Gustav out of the side of the plane. And he catches on, and James Bond is like, oh, well, I know where the button is, does the electrocution thing. And so he electrocutes Gustav because he's touching the metal, I guess. And so there's like some sort of feedback there. And
doesn't make any sense. He pushes a button.
Yes. Because you would figure
the electrocute user button.
You would figure he'd be grounded against that, but whatever. He flies backwards into the jet turbine and explodes. And this of course predates the Incredibles doing a similar thing for the unfortunate demise of the villain in that. But in this one, Rosamund Pike is dispatched by a knife through the passport Bible. What was going on? I don't know.
Art of War, of
course.
Art of
War.
It has to be incredibly tech, because he had Art of War sitting up on a little like music shelf or music stand in the corner,
yeah,
so you could read your Art of War while you're practicing your Art of War.
The knife
got flung over there and stuck in the book while they were fighting.
I like when Rosamund Pike, I'm sorry, when Gustav Graves identifies himself to his father by quoting from the Art of War, and it's like, oh no, nobody knows the Art of War except for my only son. It's like, it's not a way to identify anybody. They do that, whatever. So the knife, she uses that to kill Rosamund Pike. It seems far too instantaneous, but whatever, nobody cares. Rosamund Pike flops over. Then Halle Berry wanders off to the corner so that James Bond can wander up and look at Rosamund Pike and go, oh no, blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, Halle Berry can say, like, what was it? Like, she...
Oh, I think I broke her heart.
Yes, puns. They got to get off the plane, but apparently there were only two parachutes and they were in the front of the plane. I don't know how that works. So they go to the back
only
of the...
Only two for the entire plane.
This is the Warner Brothers cartoon. So they go to the back of the plane, and then he jettisons the two expensive cars, and then they hop in the helicopter and they get out of there. And there is the worst special effects and visual effects for the film, as the plane is just being destroyed and bits of it are falling off and being reflected into the fake glass of the thing, but it's not additive completely. It's overish kind of, and so it looks all wrong. And they're trying to get the engine to start, and they finally get it to start right before the ground, and then they fly out of there. And Halle Berry comments on how, you know, she's a jinx and they're going to die, but at least they're rich and there's all these diamonds in the back. Cut to MI6. We have, oh, and the laser turned off. Yay. But cut to MI6 at night, and Moneypenny is at her desk entering information. Miranda Frost is dead is one of the folders that she has, and then there's a CD-ROM that says military intelligence on it, which is, I find, hilarious inside of a jewel case. But she looks up and there's James, and then she has a whole thing with him where she's like, oh, James, you're back, and blah, 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 and then they kiss, and she wakes up, and it's just the VR simulation of them kissing, and John Cleese had wandered in, apparently. It's the same VR simulation goggles that James Bond had used for the scene where she had been murdered unceremoniously in the head earlier.
Yeah.
I could have done without this whole thing. This is just sad.
Yeah. It's not ideal, no.
No. Because it makes Moneypenny look like she's lusting after him and can't have him. Which I don't think is the case. That's not how I picture Moneypenny in the novelizations or movies or whatever. Actually, I've never read any of the novels. I guess I just assume that about the novels. But I just always assume that he would like to make inroads with her, and that she rejects him, because
make inroads.
I don't know. I'm trying to be nice. And she rejects him because she knows that she's better than him. And then to see this VR scene fantasy thing, it's like, well, then she doesn't think she's like better than him.
I think it's just there's a no fraternization policy and she likes her job.
Potentially. Although she does seem to flirt quite a bit, which I like. I like her flirtiness, but it's weird when you see like a scene where she actually does actually want him. They have them cut back to some, like, I don't know, interesting looking little Taos thing on a cliff. And
the Wikipedia article said it was a Buddhist hut.
Oh, Buddhist hut. And they play a little of You Only Live Twice's score, the dun, 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 that thing, a little over this.
I don't know what the hell you're talking about.
It doesn't matter. You don't need to worry about it. Thematically, it's just interesting that they did that. Problematically, that's that one where Sean Connery pretends to be Japanese because he's dead. You remember that one?
I don't.
Oh, well, it's got some problems. And in Dr. No, Dr. No is supposed to be of Chinese descent, and he's played by someone who's not, and he's covered in makeup. So that's also a problem. But ethnicity in James Bond movies, what's not great about it? That's all I'll say. And
they
wasted
all of their production resources on fake satellites and dumb crap.
And they have all these costume diamonds to pull out of Halle Berry's navel. And they're making all these jokes about, oh, it fits perfectly, blah, 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 blah. When we finally see that they're just wallowing in diamonds. They say they got to go back. And it's like, oh, that's right, we're the good guys. And it's like, oh, I don't know. Are you the good guy? I haven't seen yet. Blah, blah, blah. The end.
Yeah, then it's just over.
Yeah.
There's no infrared satellite imagery of them doing it.
Thank God. I've always wanted to have Jinx in July.
Gross.
Yes.
This movie is a pile of crap.
Yes.
I would like to try and sum up in one sentence what this movie is about. It is about the son of a North Korean general who is rich and powerful, who wants to trade weapons that he has acquired somehow for African conflict diamonds, which he can then use to do something, and has a satellite in space that shoots lasers. I was unclear if the satellite was powered by lasers or diamonds, or if the satellite was paid for by diamonds or whatever. It doesn't matter.
It's a little column A, little column B.
Sure. Because there's a lot of metaphors about how the satellite and diamonds are the same. The sun and the diamonds are the same. Anyway, he has a satellite that shoots lasers, and he's going to blow up all of the landmines, and he's going to carve a path across the demilitarized zone so that North Korea can attack South Korea. Yeah. That is the plan that James Bond has to thwart, and he has a big Nintendo glove thing that controls his satellite that can also electrocute people. And also, at the same time, he faked his own death by having his DNA replaced with a white guy.
Yeah. I think that they took heavy inspiration from previous Bond movies for this, and to great detriment. I don't feel like this is any one particular movie. I feel like they were all over the map in terms of tone and style and everything else.
In the same way that your Joel Schumacher Batmans have a little too much of everything.
Yeah, but whereas in like Batman Forever, where you can be like, oh, this is fun, that this doesn't make any sense. And this is like, oh, this is not fun, that this doesn't make any sense. This is definitely like Batman and Robin. What's strange?
It's silly fun. You got the invisible car, and the ice hotel, and you got Gustav doing that weird smile thing.
It's so strange to me that Neil Purvis and Robert Wade have basically like written all of these James Bond movies, in the modern era. And I, there are some good ones. There's some bad ones and some really bad ones. Robert Wade, Neil Purvis and Robert Wade, they worked together on, Quantum of Solace, and Skyfall and Spectre and Casino Royale. And Paul Haggis worked on Casino Royale and part of Quantum of Solace, I guess. Although none of them have a screenplay credit for that one, because that was the screenplay credit for that one, because that was the writer's strike one, where they were like reinventing things on the fly. And then there's Skyfall, which is co-written with John Logan, and Spectre, which is a co-written screenplay with John Logan and Jez Butterworth. I don't know if that's a name. co-wrote story with John Logan. And like, it's just like, why? I don't understand. Like, some of these are not so bad, and some of these are just like, how did you do this? And then, like, what is the thinking that goes on in your brain when you're coming up with this stuff? Because we've got like an ice palace that disintegrates from a laser from space. Like, it's a very like Moonraker and stuff. And then there's a lot of like You Only Live Twice theming in here, not just in the music, but like in the like exploration of another culture, and going undercover and pretending to be dead, like that part of it. But there's just this very odd aspect to all of this, and doesn't quite fit together. And I understand what they were trying to go for with Rosamund Pike being a traitor and how that would be an interesting wrinkle. But in addition to everything else, did we need that? I don't know. And Mr. Kill, I could have done without him. I didn't add a thing. In terms of like villains and whatever, it's just like, this is pretty empty. And we're supposed to feel this conflict between like Gustav and his father and all of that, but that really just comes to a head in the final like 20 minutes of the film. They had shared no scene prior to that, and it just didn't seem to matter when one of them was betrayed by the other. So I don't feel like this movie succeeded in any of the ways that it set out to do, and yet so many of these people went on to keep making Bond movies, except for John Cleese and Pierce Brosnan. So while Pierce Brosnan may have aged out of the role, I feel like he's unnecessarily blamed for a lot of the peculiarities of this film.
I mean, he's the one who says Mojito wrong, but other than that, yeah.
Yeah, well,
not really his fault.
Yeah, because like, if you consider that these writers went on to do Casino Royale, it's like, well, then, you know, Pierce Brosnan didn't write this, and Pierce Brosnan didn't, and Daniel Craig didn't write Casino Royale. So it's like, what was going on there? I don't understand.
I don't have an answer for it. It just seems mm-hmm. like they don't learn from their mistakes very well.
No. It just seems like they make a big mistake and then they hit the reset button with this franchise.
Yeah, and then they make an equal number of mistakes in a different direction and then they reset again.
Yeah. Which is why Daniel Craig, after the last one, after Spectre, said that he wasn't going to do another one. And then they said, here's money. And so he's doing another one, I guess. But like the gap between these is pretty big. It's weird how these things get made, how these James Bond movies get made, especially when they don't have like source material to go off of, where they're just trying to like invent stuff by the seat of their pants. And it could be insane or it could be like pretty interesting and you have no idea what you're going to get.
Well, I think Daniel Craig's other complaint, which is incredibly valid for any of these people, is that James Bond is an incredibly boring character to play because he has basically no depth, especially after Casino Royale, and which is the one that came right after that?
Quantum of Solace.
Was it? I guess so. The whole plot line with Eva Green's character, like that was mostly Casino Royale and went into the second movie a little bit. But after that, like, he's just, he's not doing anything. He's just kind of a miserable human being. He doesn't really get to do it much as an actor. He just is buff and punches people.
I think that's one of the things I dislike about Daniel Craig's version of Bond, is that he's so miserable. I like that Pierce Brosnan seems to be enjoying himself, which is something that I like about some of the Roger Moore movies. I know that the Roger Moore movies are not all fantastic, and for various reasons, but there's something about watching the ridiculousness of these scenarios and having somebody who's enjoying it that I like a little. Even in a situation like this, like, I don't necessarily have a problem with Pierce Brosnan in this movie, other than the fact that he seems like he's maybe aged out of being able to do some of these things and hit on several of these women. That part of it, is the weird thing. But you know, Roger Moore had the same thing in the '80s with his movies, where it was just like, so you're basically this incredibly old man who's just going around hitting on these 20-year-olds. Okay, cool. That's fine. But, yeah, I don't know.
James Bond needs to be a little bit ridiculous. Mm-hmm. He's got his gadgets. He's got his larger-than-life bad guys. But this movie is just, it's too much.
Would you say that any of the Daniel Craig movies have gadgets and gizmos and ridiculousness that comes to this level?
Comes to this level? God, no.
Mm-hmm.
No. I can't imagine any... well, I mean, there are some weird things, but, like, I don't think a self-respecting spy movie these days could get away with doing crap like they used to do in these old Bond movies.
Yeah, that's true.
Audiences just would, like, immediately tune out and not tolerate it.
Yeah. Well, we're in agreement. So
that's weird. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes, yes, yes. Doctor, yes.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
Doctor, yes, yes, yes. He's a guy who started a podcast network, but secretly is using it to take over the world.
Doctor Yas Queen. That'd be
that's
good.
A different one.
Yeah. Okay. Fine. But it'd be modern take, I feel. So, in conclusion, bad movie. We both hate it. I don't think either one of us feels like this. There are any like redeeming things about it.
I mean, this is the movie that is so bad. I can watch it when it's on TV because I just stare at it and I shake my head. I am not attempting to like this movie when I watch it. I am just letting it occur and going like, wow, look at this. Whereas, as I think I said before, things like Tomorrow Never Dies, I don't want to put those in my eyeballs anymore.
That's so strange to me because I would rather watch Tomorrow Never Dies if it came on TV and I was just sitting there at home doing something and it's like, oh, well, we're halfway through Tomorrow Never Dies. I'd be like, great, let's keep going.
No, this has gone past the threshold of a movie that is bad to a movie that is so bad that I can just sit there and go like, wow, look at, albeit not like if I have, you know, a limited amount of time and I need to choose something to watch and use my time wisely. This is like, I have decided today that I am going to sit on this couch and do absolutely nothing. Oh, look, there's a sports game over here. There's Die Another Day over there. I'll watch a little bit of Die Another Day.
Okay.
I like watching bad movies.
You need like a hobby? You need to like take up crochet?
I mean, watching bad movies is kind of a hobby.
I don't understand that at all on this podcast. But let's bid each other adieu. As the sun sets on Pierce Brosnan and this franchise. And we will return next week to talk about, I don't know, something.
You know what happens when the sun sets on a franchise?
God opens a window?
No, the predators come out to feast or whatever.
Oh, yes. Well, I pray that you're safe.
Yeah, let's blast this franchise in the face with a space laser.
Mm-hmm. Diamonds in the grill.
Oh boy.
I'm gonna wake up, yes and no. I'm gonna kiss some part of. I'm gonna keep this secret. I'm gonna close my body now.
Analyze this.